Okay, this is continuing with Radhakrishnan on 28th March, 72. The first part of this, or the last part of this interview is on 11B. The first part is on 12A and 12B. This is 13A. That sounds confusing because it is. Okay, now, are you working on looking for OH emission, but yeah, with any continuum source as background?
No, yeah. As I was saying, the detection of OH emission in the direction of two non-thermal sources, two supernova remnants, W28 and W44, raise the question as to whether these sources merely provided physical conditions in their neighborhood to provide the same kind of OH emission as you found close to H2 regions, or whether they were providing the continuum radiation, which is a signal input to the mesas that existed everywhere, waiting, so to speak.
In other words, whether the input or the pump that was the limiting condition to seeing it.
Exactly. And so the experiment that I did was to look in the direction of the number of extragalactic sources at galactic frequencies. Sources like 273, they have 87, Hercules, and 353, and all the rest, just to see if there was any OH emission. Obviously, the OH emission would not have been from these sources, but there was some there that would have shown that you had regions which were pumped, but which needed an external stimulus. And needless to say, the result was negative because it didn't be published.
And you also looked for H2+.
H2+, yeah. There was, I think, at least two separate sessions of trying to do that.
And a line at around 1400 megahertz?
There are several lines with different probabilities. They're all in the neighborhood of the hydrogen line, and the frequency is somewhat less, I think, 1440, 1403, 1399, and so on, different probabilities. And I looked, I think, at two of the most probable ones in the direction of a number of continuum sources. I was really looking for the thing in absorption.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to your hydrogen absorption study.
Well, hydrogen, all of the hydrogen absorption work has been written up very satisfactorily in this Apogee supplement, which is now about number 203. And number one deals with the development of this instrument, which really took a long time. It took a long time to think of how to do it. Well, the instrument is described and so on. In paper number one, paper number two deals with the observations that were specifically designed to establish or to disprove the two-component hypothesis, to be floating around the lock. And it's interesting that in the 2 or 3 years prior to, in the last 3 or 4 years, you might say from 68 to 69 and so on, more and more people started talking about the two-component thing. It almost became something fashionable to assume. But it was never really properly demonstrated. And I think there's very little doubt that Clark's work has done this now. Then there was a lot of galactic work on galactic sources, helped establish distances and so on, all that's described.
Right.
I don't really think that's
no. And well, we haven't covered your pulsar. How did you get off on the pulsar kick?
Oh, I didn't really get onto it. In fact, I was off against doing anything like pulsars simply because I. Another pet aversion of mine, and I call the bandwagon syndrome.
Right.
And those people. And when pulsars came up, Parks, as usual, were always ready to get him second in a big way. He was very anxious to Again, looking out the fifth, they suggested that I should really tackle this problem because it was very important. I said I wouldn't touch the garbage pile. I thought it was one of the marvelous things that we discovered. Doing the way and rushing in like that. Any number of people I could name, except I wouldn't do it on the step. You know, they spend all their time doing this sort of thing. But it turned out I ended up at Parks. It might have actually been during some other session, but very shortly after the Volksnarbe one had been discovered. And I think we were really just trying to look at this pulsar. It's almost an interesting story, in a particular movie. I'll tell you about how it was. And so we just wanted to look at this pulsar. And of course, the way to do it, which is now a pretty standard way, simply to put this on a pulse-height analyzer and run it via high frequencies. Mm-hmm. That wasn't done before. As far as we knew, Cambridge papers and all of the afterwards. And we had a pulse-height analyzer, which was really used as an integration device for the Langer receiver. So this was triggered off with a signal generator and sort of set to the right frequency. And we thought the pulsar would just sit there and integrate, and we could look at it. And the pulsar kept moving on. So almost as if pulsars always do this for me, as you will appreciate when I finish the rest of the story. And this annoyed me because I wanted to see where the I wanted to see what the pulse shape looked like and so on, just out of curiosity. And no matter how we twiddle this goddamn oscillator, we couldn't get the pulsar to sort of stay where it should be, get drifting. Mm-hmm. So at that time we'd just been setting up the frequency very roughly. So although Cambridge published a figure to seven, a period to seven figures or something like that. So we said we better do this carefully if we want to look at this one side. We set it up and stood them up, and then we said we better take the rotation of the Earth and all the rest of this into account. So we ran this frequency on the program, calculating line frequencies, right, and so on, accurate to the empty place. And we put this on, and the damn pulsar still kept drifting. At this point, we were really interested in it. I just couldn't understand why it wouldn't stay still. And working backwards, by taking the frequency we'd put in and the rate it was drifting and so on, it was clear that pulsar seemed to have frequency different from what was published. But the difference wasn't in the seventh place. But there was about a thousand times, the error was a thousand times the accuracy of the published measurements. And this really intrigued me, and I worried. There was something like 1,064,000. I said, what the hell could this mean? And I just slipped into playing with pulsars, and I had to find out why. Then it occurred to me that I was looking for all sorts of reasons, unlikely reasons. It occurred to me that the error, the difference between the apparent period that we had and the very precise period that Cambridge had published, the difference was something like 1,064,000 and 64,000, etc., etc., so many hundreds and hundreds. Precisely the number of pulses per day. So I said, how could this be? And then suddenly it got to me that Cambridge had missed one pulse per day. And I said, how could this happen? And I sat up and thought about the way that they made their measurements. Because they could only see the pulse out 4 minutes a day because it was a transit instrument. So you can never get the period by looking at the pulse out for 1 day. So you look at it for several days, and the more days you look, you look at it, the more subharmonics you eliminate. And they'd done everything right, but they'd actually missed one pulse per day. So this was the first paper that was published on pulsars, which of course created a big sensation. It created all kinds of upsets. The chemists, I found out that what a terrible thing to be told if you counted one wrong. But it was also very important, or appeared important at that time, because everybody in his grandmother was claiming optical identification, and they'd all been integrating using the Cambridge period.
Everybody went back.
Yeah, and our period is wrong. Nothing ever came along with it.
This was verified, that your period was correct.
Question of verification. Somebody actually had the bloody nerve to say that he has checked our period and found it right. He's just lucky that I didn't. Right? Tell him where he can take his confirmation. Not only did we supply a better period, but we explained precisely why it was different. And, well, we also published dispersion problems and so on. Anyway, that was the first thing I got interested in. The next time I looked at Pulsar was at the Vela Pulsar. I went up to help Max, who's doing this observation.
Max
Gonzalo.
Oh, yeah.
And he was going to look at a whole lot of Pulsar, many of them found by him. And I was looking at the Vela Pulsar. And I was trying to keep this thing still, because it looked like the, I wanted to see what the polarization was like. And so I did the same thing, you calculate the period, you set it up in your lab, your rotation of the Earth and so on. Plus I sort of stood still, and then when I looked at it later, again it wasn't quite still, and the following day it seemed to be all wrong. And so another big investigation into why the Earth didn't stand still. This time I just found the period and the pulsar was changing.
You didn't know about any secular changes, or?
This was the second pulsar that was found to change its period. The crab thing had just been published
before. Right, so you did know that that there was one that had a secular change.
Right.
Yeah. That was,
this was the second fastest pulsar.
Right. Therefore the second fastest change.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
This became a pattern one day afterwards. At that time, I just thought the crab pulsar was very... I mean, the crab pulsar was so fantastic, one didn't think of that almost.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, who established the crab change? Was it?
Oh, Arecibo.
Arecibo? I just don't know the history.
Oh, yeah. That was great. So anyway, it was found that this thing changed in the period. And that was published in the paper. The importance of that paper was really not period changing pulsars. But it really had to do with my interpretation. Anyway, you have to read this paper. As far as I'm concerned, that's the paper that established a rotational model for pulsars, because it showed that you had a repeating pattern of polarization, which, no matter what the polarization is due to, it had to be tied up to a magnetic field in some way. This magnetic field had to be attached to the pulsar in some way. And the only way that you could get this, the same pattern repeating, in spite of the fact that everybody in the universe rotates, it was only if the pulse were tied up with a certain longitude. There was no other explanation for it. I mean, the logic is irrefutable. So that type of, and we had the further fact that the period changed, but the polarization also changed in the new period, and so on.
Do you have an oblique magnetic field model in there?
Oh, yeah. You see, it was only suggested in that thing. It was more or less clearly established that it had to be a rotating model for pulsar. And then I felt that I had to really go back and prove that the change in the position of the polarization was not due to Faraday rotation of any kind. For example, even if you had a rotating object, then you had a plasma cloud, for example, that was going around with it, and as the thing rotated, you would look through different lengths of density in different fields, and therefore the Faraday rotation would be different, therefore you would get rotation and polarization. So you had to separate the Faraday rotation and any intrinsic changes in angle polarization. I figured the only way you could do this was to look at this thing at more than one frequency and see if the rotation was the same for all angles of the sphere.
Yeah.
The third time I went along, about this time I had vast amount of experience in setting up in getting pulsars to stop so I could look at them and so I had this thing all set up, and God damn it, it didn't move again. And there was no way I could get this thing to stop. And I spent a whole week struggling with this Dick Manchester, which was the name of this project. And I decided You must remember, you know, until something is found and published and established, when you see something very new, it's difficult to not to suspect some instrumental.
Oh, sure, you don't know what the hell's going on.
But I came to the conclusion that the pulsar had suddenly changed its period. And I said, how could this be? And I came to the conclusion that the only way this could happen is if the radius had changed in some way. And I remember Fred Hoyle was there. I told him this, and I said, now this is a southern pulsar, minus 45 degrees. No one else has this kind of equipment anyway in the southern hemisphere. And I know that something absolutely crazy like that, the radius change has happened. I'm going to really sit and think about it and learn all about neutron stars and so on, and work on this maybe a month or 2 months. The following day, there was a telegram saying that the JPL people, or this telephone call saying the JPL people had also observed this because they were really going right down to the horizon. Their 85-foot vision, amazing. See? So, we had to publish the thing. So there were two papers in Nature. Anyway, this is...
Yeah, the very interesting.
Yeah, that's rather interesting. The title is where it says detection of the change of state. Pulsar.
Did the, was it Ripley?
And Downs, yeah.
And Downs.
Oh, the two papers came together.
That's not Dennis Downs, is it?
No.
Did they also propose a change in?
Some such thing as it. Anyway, I remember the discussions I had with Fred, where I was trying to show him, I'd gone through this in my mind, that it couldn't be due to a satellite and a thing going in an elliptic orbit. See, I was trying to think. Period changing with the things going on. It couldn't possibly be that it had to be something absolutely sudden because of two straight lines. It was clear enough from our data. And yep. Later, Berkeley and Downs came out, they had this thing to something like two orders of magnitude more accurate now. Yep. And I had personal satisfaction having gone through all this heartache alone.
So three times pulsars would not stop for you.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
But anyway,
all for different reasons.
Yeah, but the thing is, that time, after having sorted this out, I then looked at the two different frequencies and showed that independent frequency, the Faraday rotation, was the same for every part of this pulse, see? Even after the period changed and so on.
Uh-huh.
And that paper, which was in Astrophysical Letters, which is putting forward the magnetic pole model. In other words, saying the radiation came out from the pole and so on. In a sense, it still stands in another.
Yeah.
A little bit. And there were a few other things. I think there were over half a dozen papers published on pulsars, but if you want to get the history of that straight, not only the work on the past, practically everywhere else on pulsars until 1969, July. I wrote a review, I was invited to give a review talk somewhere. The first time I really sat down and worked, produced a review paper, which deals with absolutely everything that was done in
the first year.
Yeah, in the first 15 months. Very little has been done since.
In the way of history?
Yeah. In other words, almost all. 90% of what's known has already been.
Oh, I see. Where was this paper? Again?
Also in the Australian Astronomical Society of Australia.
Do you want to, on the tape, or would you rather not say something about the business about parks never quite reaching its potential?
I'd rather not.
Okay.
Feel very strongly
about it. Okay. Well, is there anything at Meudon that you were hired to look into the problems of the millimeter interferometer thinking about it?
Yeah, but the only thing I came up with was to suggest that they use redundancy to get rid of atmospheric variations that you've told you about.
Yeah.
hardly a contribution. The idea was put forward by Jensen in 58 and enlarged by Rhodes 10, 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. It would be a new thing to actually use it for radio and
phone. Yeah. Well, the final thing I'd like to ask you about is the Rama Institute. You left Australia and you could have worked just about anywhere if you wanted to, I think, and stayed in the, quote, mainstream of radio astronomy. But now you're going back to India, and what do you hope to do there? Is it going to be radio astronomy necessarily, or?
No. There will be a little radio astronomy. There might even be lots of radio astronomy if I can really think of some very, very different, very special instrument to build in the next few years. But otherwise, it could just as well be anything.
Your main requirement is it to involve a novel technique or an entirely new approach to some problem in physics in the broadest sense.
Something like that. It's very hard to express, but my reasons for going to India are really very similar to Dave's reasons for joining me on the boat. I can't spend the rest of my life going around doing radio astronomy of the kind I've been doing. It's just not worth it. I mean, there's no point in just extrapolating this curve. I can do that in my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that it's been unsuccessful in the sense that I'm not about to lose my job, or I'm not about to run out of office, or anything like that. But there must be more to life. I mean, I want a bigger challenge. I mean, I want bigger rewards, and you can't get that unless you try to accept bigger challenges. Even if it's a failure, it's more, even if you fail, there's more satisfaction than it's better to have loved and lost.
And you never would know unless you tried. Well, thank you very much for all the time you spent.
My pleasure.
That ends the interview with Radhakrishnan on 28th March 1972.